the ever-changing challenge of protecting Maine's fisheries and its fishing heritage. Maine's fisheries, including lobsters, haddock, scallops, shrimp, oysters, clams, sea urchins, bloodworms, and more, are a big part of the Maine economy. According to the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, in 2012, Maine's seafood industry accounted for $1.875 billion in sales. Every single one of Maine's fisheries faces challenges. Warming water temperatures, ocean acidification, historical overfishing, international competition, price pressures, you name it. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with the head of the Department of Marine Resources, Commissioner Pat Kelleher, about the state of Maine's fisheries and recent developments in research and regulations. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. Maine's fisheries, including lobsters, haddock, scallops, shrimp, oysters, clams, sea urchins, bloodworms, and more, are a big part of the Maine economy. According to the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, in 2012, Maine's seafood industry accounted for $1.875 billion in sales. Every single one of Maine's fisheries faces challenges. Warming water temperatures, ocean acidification, historical overfishing, international competition, price pressures, you name it. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with the head of the Department of Marine Resources, Commissioner Pat Kelleher, about the state of Maine's fisheries and recent developments in research and regulations. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post the Maine Calling Facebook page. Pat, in doing some research for today's program, I pulled up some statistics from NOAA. And now these are from 2012, and it has the total impacts of Maine's seafood industry at the time at $1.8 billion. That's a lot of money. Is that still pretty accurate, or has the number changed since then?
NOAA would calculate a little bit differently than we do. And as we talked earlier, it doesn't include species like elvers. But you're still looking at nearly $2 billion of economic activity on the coast of Maine through commercial fishing and aquaculture.
Right. These numbers don't include elvers. They don't include oysters. They don't include salmon. They're not looking at aquaculture at all. How much does aquaculture alone bring into the state?
Yeah. And last year alone, all products raised by aquaculturists brought in just the landed value to the harvester is $107 million.
Okay. And does DMR regulate both the with the wild fisheries and the aquaculture?
Yeah, we have regulatory authority over both industries.
And what about seaweed?
Seaweed as well.
Wow, okay.
Seaweed, when you look at the value of the seaweed coming across the dock, it's not that much. But if you look at the value-added profit associated with it, it's nearly a $20 million industry in Maine.
Wow, and so mainly that's the processing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So let's talk about some of the what's in the news, some of the species in the news. And I'm going to start with shrimp. I know I'm not the only person who really misses Maine shrimp. This is the second or third year without a season.
This is the third year without a full season.
What is going on? I understand there's some limited catch for research. How does that work?
Yeah, so we started seeing declines in the overall population of shrimp 5 or 6 years ago. We kept ratcheting down on the overall harvest to a point where we needed to put a full moratorium into place. And it's not because of overfishing. It's because of the warming waters in the Gulf of Maine. Northern shrimp, we're at the southern extent of their range. So if we're going to see any contraction of a population, then it's going to be felt in Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts before it's felt anywhere else. So in order to continue to do studies on the shrimp, though, we did create a what's called a research set-aside. This year, don't hold me to it, but I think it's around 50 metric tons, and they're harvesting those shrimp now. There's 10 boats, one from Mass, one from New Hampshire, and eight from the state of Maine, draggers. And then we have five or six trappers as well that are out catching them.
What are you hoping to learn from these boats that are catching a limited amount of shrimp?
It's really a snapshot of what the population is. A lot of fishermen like to think of this as another way to gauge the population because they can catch them fairly quickly because there's not a lot of boats around. But this has nothing to do with the overall population. We're looking at in the age at size, so we're trying to figure out carapace length. As you see a population contract, is the overall size of the shrimp, is that changing? Is it getting bigger? Is it getting smaller? Those are the type of things that also will give us some reflection on what the health of the stock is.
Is there any hope that the shrimp will rebound? I mean, if it's warming water, there's no indication water's going to cool down again.
Well, in the 50s, it actually did. The shrimp population actually collapsed in the 50s. There were a three-year period where we saw a big spike in water temperature in the Gulf of Maine. And back then, the regulation, the management wasn't quite as tight. So what you had was fishermen not being able to find them, so they just went and did something else. But the population did collapse. As the waters got colder in the Gulf of Maine, that population recovered, and we have seen kind of the ups and downs of shrimp management and shrimp populations ever since. So if we see a change, that would drive a fishery. But we're actually talking about, from a policy perspective at ASMFC, Atlantic State Marine Fisheries Commission, should we be allowing some small-scale fishery in the face of an environmental change, knowing that the stock may never recover? And so that is it's a different way of looking at fisheries and fisheries management. But warming waters is the biggest challenge we face on the East Coast, and especially here in the Gulf of Maine.
Do we have a sense of how many degrees the temperature have to cool down to have the shrimp fishery come back?
It's only gone up 3. So it's not a big temperature difference. When you look at the average temperature change, we've been taking temperature data in Booth Bay Harbor for over 100 years. So that's a surface water temperature. And then when we look offshore and deeper waters and how it's changed offshore as well at the buoys. So it's not a big change, but it doesn't need to be a big change in order to really shift a balance of a species. So because we don't get icing in the intertidal zone anymore, we don't see a big scouring in the winter, so we had big booms of green crabs. That's because of warming water. We have black sea bass in Maine, actually regulating black sea bass in the state of Maine where we never had them before. So we also have a booming lobster population, though, which is linked again to warming waters because they sexually mature faster.
I was going to ask you that question next. I know that the southern New England's lobster population is not doing nearly as well as Maine's. Is that because the water is just a little bit warmer off the coast of Massachusetts?
It's once you get below Massachusetts, mostly Connecticut, Long Island Sound, New York, those fisheries there were all impacted by very high spikes in water temperature, which caused other problems. Shell disease being one. And that was one of the biggest drivers for the collapse of that population.
Are you worried? Are you worried if water temperatures continue to rise in Maine that Maine's lobster population could be in trouble?
I'm very worried. We have seen, I don't know about last year, but we have 4 of the last 5 years where we've seen a declining settlement. We do 3 surveys. We have a settlement survey, a ventless trap survey, and then we look at the landings. Lobster landings. Settlement, we had 4 or 5 years where we're seeing a decline.
And what does that mean, settlement?
When a lobster egg hatches, it starts to develop, but it floats to the surface and then floats in the upper part of the water column until it gets a little bit bigger than between a nickel and a quarter. And then those lobsters will settle out to the bottom. They'll settle to the bottom, and that's when we survey them. It's a dive survey. We have staff that actually goes down to the bottom, and they count lobsters in a square area. And then put that into the assessments that are done on an annual basis.
And you're seeing that number go down?
We've seen a decline there, but we're not seeing a decline in the next, the ventless trap survey, and that's a regular lobster trap with no escape vents in it. So the good news is there may be another thing. It could be something else going on. They could be settling different. They could be settling in deeper water where we're not capturing that. So, but it's left us with leaving a very cautious eye to the population. We're harvesting at all-time high rates, as well as Canada doing the same thing. But the population is tremendous. The amount of juvenile, the amount of small lobsters on the bottom is unbelievable. Going through 30 or 40 lobsters in a trap to keep one. That's how many small lobsters are on the bottom.
Mm. How much, you mentioned that we're selling more than ever. There have been articles written about how lobster, everything from the food trucks in America's big cities selling lobster rolls to the Asian market. What kind of change are we seeing in the lobster market, and where do you project it's going
to
go?
Well, I mean, even if we start to see a downturn, the overall value of Maine lobster on both the worldwide market and within the domestic market remains fairly strong. We have a lot more marketing we can do, though, just in this country. Everybody wants to talk about China, Japan, Korea. Those are very important markets that the Maine lobster dealers are working hard to attract and then maintain. And then you have the Maine Lobster Marketing Collaborative that the industry pays into. It's about $2.7 million a year now that is spent on doing work here within the United States to expand the market here. And the focus here is new shell, where Canada harvests mostly hard shell lobsters. Most of the product here is a soft shell lobster or a new shell lobster.
Is that because it's easier to process?
No, they both process. They can both process as easily. It's just how our fishery is set up. We have a year-round fishery. Most of the harvest is really June through September or October. We do have a fairly robust offshore fleet that's also fishing that's bringing in hard shell through the winter. But Canada is set up to catch hard shell lobsters.
So the bottom line for lobsters in Maine is that right now it looks good, but really, really, really concerned about any further rise in the ocean temperature.
We've done several things in-state. We have the lobster license plate, which everybody sees up and down the coast. That actually supplies about 250,000 annually. We have a research program that we're setting up right now, getting ready to do RFPs to answer some really critical questions on aging. ASMFC is looking at this from a management perspective. And the way we're looking at it, because we're not in a collapse, is how can we ensure the lobster population remains resilient in the face of a changing environment?
Okay. Let's move on to scallops. Article in the Portland Press Herald just this morning about sort of the conflict between larger boats catching scallops and smaller boats catching scallops. Is this a really critical issue in this scallop fishery?
Yeah, it's critical to the overall diversity of harvesters within the state of Maine. About 10 years ago, the council, there was no fishery in the northern Gulf of Maine about 10 years ago, and the council made a set-aside to maintain access for the northern Gulf of Maine permit holders. While there were quite a few of them, there was no product, so nobody was going out and fishing. As the scallops have rebounded, we're seeing more access by the northern Gulf of Maine boats, but they're treated differently than the big boats. There's a few big boats in Maine, but most of them are New Bedford, Massachusetts-based boats, and they're fishing way offshore. And when they're not finding product, those big boats come into the northern Gulf of Maine, and they get to fish on product without having any restrictions put in place other than the size of their drag. There's no daily limit. They can come in, the quota, what they catch doesn't count towards the northern Gulf of Maine quota, where a small Maine boat is required to fish 200 pounds a day. They only have so many days that they can fish because of the quota.
And they're in the same areas.
In the same areas. So we need to fix I hate to call it a big boat versus small boat, but we need to correct the management so the access is recognized more on an equal footing, and then we have a situation where when the big boats are going to come up, that they have to follow the same rules as a small boat, something along that line. I'm not sure how the council is going to rectify it in the end, but it's a priority of the council, and it's certainly a priority of DMRs to fix this problem.
And when could this be resolved by?
The council's going to take it up, I believe, at one of their spring meetings. But it may be a situation where we're going to make an adjustment now, but there could be an allocation conversation, which takes a longer process through the council.
So only a decade since this part of Maine has even been open to scalloping. How much of the coast of Maine or the ocean off the coast is open for scalloping?
Well, these are the offshore beds in federal waters, but our Maine scallop fishery is also rebounding. We fish, there's a little bit of fishing a little bit south of Casco Bay or to the west of Casco Bay, but mostly it's Casco Bay and east. And when the department closed about 10% of the entire coast 7 or 8 years ago, then we used that benefit. We had a rebuilding in areas. We utilized a new management approach called rotational management. That rotational management, along with the closures that the previous administration had put in place, have changed this fishery inshore dramatically, where we had about $500,000 worth of landed value only 6 or 7 years ago. It's now a $7 million fishery.
Is that because, you know, you go to a restaurant, it'll say this is a diver scallop versus a drag scallop. Is that because the diver scallops fetch much more money?
Well, it's the inshore scallop is really the important thing. I mean, market people love to market a diver scallop, but if it's a scallop that's been dragged up off a large boat that's doing multi-day trips, and then they're soaked in any kind of a liquid or to retain their weight, that scallop's not nearly as good as a day boat scallop.
Yeah. And how much of the fishery is each right now?
Well, the overall offshore fishery, including the limited access value, I mean, that's one of the biggest fisheries on the East Coast. But if you look at our inshore fishery at 7 million and then you look at around a 70,000 pound quota associated for the Northern Gulf of Maine, it's a very valuable fishery, and it's important that we retain access that ensures sustainability for the future.
Pat, I want to ask you about groundfish. I'm looking at this chart from the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration. And, you know, in 2003, it had 4,600,000, the revenues from landing of cod and haddock, by 2012 down to 1.3. If I could continue this chart, would it continue to have gone down?
Yeah, it would. This is... It's both a management failure and a environmental condition issue associated with the council. I've been a critic of the council in years past where the council was not reacting fast enough to changes. I think we now have a very functional New England Fisheries Management Council that is more reactive, is doing the work it needs to do under the auspices of the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Conservation Act. So I think the right management is being put in place, but now it's will the stocks recover as the environment has changed, as the water has warmed? And that's really the million-dollar question.
We hear how cod is, you know, some people use the word collapsed. Yeah. Other people use the word, you know, softer terms, like in trouble. How would you describe it? And then also, what about haddock? How's the haddock fishery?
Well, haddock fishery offshore in Georges Bank is incredible. Had the biggest year class ever in 2011, which is great news for the larger boats fishing offshore. Inshore in the Gulf of Maine, we've seen some uptick in haddock, but really holding the line on cod. There has been change in other species, though. Less desirable species like pollock or redfish, but still a species that fishermen with quota can still access to still maintain their place within the fishery. But Maine's groundfish fishery, I mean, used to be 200-plus boats, and we're down to, you know, 20 or 30 active groundfish boats, and they're doing all they can, a lot of them, all they can to hang on.
And is the temperature of the water affecting the haddock and cod and other groundfish as well?
There is links to temperature change and where they may spawn or how they may move. But at the same time, fishermen are also, because of the very strict quota limits, every time they try to key in on a different species to catch, they're still finding them. So fishermen will tell you, which is pretty common, they're going to tell you that what you're seeing in your science and in your data is not the same thing that we see offshore. And usually, in a lot of cases, we are, from a science and management perspective, we may be 2 or 3 years behind what a fisherman's actually seeing. And that's certainly the case with groundfish. So we're seeing some positive signs, but not to the point where managers are ready to make changes yet.
I've heard the analogy that scientists take snapshots where the fishermen see a film.
I think that's a pretty good analogy.
All right. Well, we do have to take a break. If you have questions for DMR Commissioner Pat Kelleher, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Revision Energy, helping Mainers power their homes with solar, heat pump, and storage technology. RevisionEnergy.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we look back on a chapter of paranoia and persecution in America in which the president, Congress, the courts, and the press all played a part. We'll talk with journalist Glenn Frankel, whose new book is about the Hollywood blacklist and the making of the classic film High Noon. Join us.
Tune into Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock. Maine Public is seeking an experienced HR professional to lead all aspects of our human resources functions for our statewide public broadcasting organization. We're looking for an HR director who's passionate about the work and mission of public broadcasting and has deep experience in all aspects of employee and labor relations, benefit sourcing, performance management, and HR compliance. If you or someone you know has experience and enthusiasm and would complement Maine Public's dynamic and talented workforce, there's more information and details on how to apply on our website, mainepublic.org.
Underwater and just
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Maine Department of Marine Resources Commissioner Pat Kelleher. We invite you to join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We will start with Kipperly, who's calling from Searsport. Hi, Kipperly. Go ahead.
Hi, it's Kipperly from the Penobscot Marine Museum.
Oh, hi. Go ahead.
And if your listeners enjoy this topic, I invite them to attend our history conference this year, which is delving into the statement, human innovation and technology have proven to be too successful for the health of our fisheries and local ecosystem. And we'll have a lineup of scientists, historians, journalists, activists, consumers, and fishermen who will try to answer the question, how did this happen and what do we do now? The conference is on April 8th at the UMaine Hutchinson Center in Belfast, and we'll continue to explore this theme in our summer exhibits and programming here in Searsport.
Okay. Sipperly, I invite you to go to Maine Calling's Facebook page and post information.
It's already there.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go to Twitter now. A question, are you concerned at the proliferation of kelp and other species being spread by lobster traps?
Kelp and other species being spread by lobster traps. I'm not sure we have any solid data that that traps are moving anything that would be considered invasive within the Gulf of Maine. We would be concerned if we were talking about an invasive species that was not present here, but I don't have any hard evidence that says we're moving it from one habitat to another.
Okay. This is not the question from Twitter, but I want to ask you, Commissioner, about kelp. We mentioned that most of the market right now is in the processing, but there's really been a lot of attention around kelp and around seaweed, and that this might be the next sort of really stylish, popular food. What's being done now to make sure that the future seaweed harvest in Maine is a responsible one?
So that's something that the department has tried to tackle from a rockweed perspective. We have not gone into the other seaweeds such as kelp because it's being harvested wild at a very low level. The good thing with kelp is that we're seeing more and more innovation on the aquaculture side, where and it's a great business for somebody that has that may be growing something or harvesting something in the summer month, because you can grow out the kelp to an edible size within the winter months. Kelp is definitely something that is a burgeoning market. The issue associated with rockweed, though, becomes sustainability. And we have a cutting height in place. We're only seeing it's less than 2% of the overall available biomass harvested from a rockweed perspective. It's a very clean fishery. People think there's a lot of seaweed that harvest that's going to have a lot of bycatch associated with it. There may be some periwinkles and other things that are caught in it, or maybe even a crab or two. In a lot of those cases, in periwinkles and crabs, they may even be an invasive species that's being part of the bycatch. But people are concerned about the loss of available habitat because it's going to impact lobsters. Well, we've been harvesting about the same amount of rockweed along this coast for 15 or 20 years. We've seen a slight uptick recently, but nothing that would drive us to be concerned that that fishery is going to impact another species like lobster. And it certainly hasn't happened in Canada, where it's harvested at a much greater volume than it is here. There is a lawsuit right now on who owns the seaweed. The department's position, it is a fishery. This seaweed is not taking its nourishment from the ground. It's held onto a rock, but it is taking its nourishment from the water and from the air. So we do treat it as a fishery. It's treated in law as a fishery. But the lawsuit that's in the lower courts now, which will eventually be appealed, is trying to determine, okay, who actually owns that seaweed in the intertidal zone. So that's the big question that is remaining at this point in time.
In the intertidal zone. Interesting. Yeah. Was this lawsuit brought forward by landowners, people who live on the coast?
Yeah, two landowners against a company in eastern Maine. It's actually a Canadian-based company, but they brought it against a company in eastern Maine.
Hmm. Interesting question for lawyers. We've got Michael calling from Camden. Hi, Camden. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Good. Are you on a speakerphone by chance, Michael?
Not anymore.
Okay, go ahead.
I'd like to hear a little bit from the commissioner about the plans for the future of aquaculture in Maine. I've been somewhat involved with that in the past, and it's been a very painful experience. As late as 2008, I was in charge of a company on the coast that had to lay off 60 people because of rules and regulations that are not replicated in competing markets such as Canada, for instance.
So, Michael, about aquaculture, are you talking about oysters? Are you talking about mussels? Are you talking about salmon?
In this particular case, I've been involved in mussels and salmon in the state of Maine, and there are companies in this world who would like to add $500 million worth of business to the state of Maine very fast, but they're afraid to, and they don't want to invest any more money in it. I mean, last time I was part of it, we lost about $40 million.
Okay, so you're not that easy to comprehend, but I'll ask Commissioner Kelleher about that. Are the regulations here in Maine driving out or keeping away potential business opportunities?
The regulations here in Maine for related to aquaculture are challenging, and they were developed to be challenging because of the fact that the department has been given the authority by the legislature to lease public bottom and public water to a private company or a private individual. So because of that, we have a very rigorous leasing process to go through. And what will happen in the course of that process is it can be very quick, 5 to 7 months in period of time if the application has been deemed fully acceptable by our leasings officers and there's no opposition. But where we start to get into problems within the leasing process is when people start to object. And I think I've been sued as the department head at least 3 times now because of people who object to it being in their backyard in many cases. And we have also rejected a lot of leaseholders because of their impact to flora or fauna or other fisheries associated with within the area where they want to practice being an aquaculturist. So there are challenges, but it's also the biggest growth potential that we have within our marine economy. If you took all of the aquaculture in the state of Maine, it would fit inside the Portland Jetport. If you look at the Portland Jetport, the fence around the Portland Jetport, it would all fit inside of that. So if you think of how long the coast of Maine is, the potential for growth is there. We've invested heavily into expanding staff. We put another hearings examiner on. We have more people doing the field work associated with the permitting. And we're seeing some positive change, and we hope to see even more. It's never going to be a simple process, but a little more streamlined process to make it a little bit more efficient going forward.
Where do you see the most opportunity for growth? Or do you see, we mentioned mussels, we mentioned salmon, we mentioned oysters. What do you see?
I think all of those shellfish species, but scallops is one that is also up and coming. More and more people are looking at technology from overseas, especially in Japan, for a different way to grow scallops here in the state of Maine. We've made the collecting of scallop spat or scallop seeds accessible now for these aquaculturists, and I think that is another great growth potential as well.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for your call. We'll move to Cape Elizabeth and Togue. Hi, Togue. Go ahead.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, Commissioner Kelleher. I'm actually listening to this program as I'm packaging up scallops to ship all over the country. And I'm calling really to say thank you, because I'm able to do this largely because DMR has continued to make the difficult decisions in terms of making sure that our scallop fishery is keeping on the trend towards recovery. So it's hard to make those tough decisions, so I'm calling to say thank you for that. We produce the best scallops on the planet, and we also have a great story because they're so sustainable. And I also wanted to say thank you for shedding some light on this Northern Gulf of Maine scallop issue. This is a critically important issue for our fishermen, and I agree with you. It's not good to portray it as a fight of small boats against big boats, but it's also important that we stand up for what's right. And so I thank you and Terry Stockwell and Trish Cheney and all of the fishermen that are taking part in that fight right now.
Thanks, Togue. Togue is known as the scallop queen along the coast of Maine, and she's probably one of the most vocal advocates for scallop and scallop management. We with our rotational management, are actively involved in opening and closing, mostly closing areas in a timely fashion to ensure sustainability. And they're very tough calls to make, because every time we close an area, we're impacting somebody's livelihood and making them move to other areas, which creates another challenge because of overcrowding. And it becomes a little bit of a domino effect. But even with those problems, we have seen a great growth within our inshore fishery, and it's something that I think needs to continue. And we've been willing to be very adaptive in this approach. It started really as an experiment, and at the end of the day, it's really about leaving product on the bottom. Where we used to say, "Okay, 75 days, go get them." Now it's, okay, you have 75 days, but this area is closed. They'll remain closed for two years while you can go here and here, but now we're going to use a trigger mechanism and shut the areas off when they reach a certain harvest level.
After an area is shut down, is it then seeded, or is it all natural?
It's all natural. That's why you want to leave product on the bottom. Then they will, when the scallop will go through, go through the process of spawning, the seed will get up in the water column. It'll carry out and resettle and redistribute. And we're seeing that up and down the coast, where we're seeing more and more juvenile species within our scallop survey work that we're doing.
Togue, thanks so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We have an email from Larissa. Could the DMR commissioner comment on whether the marine worm harvesting over-harvesting limits the ability of shellfish and fish populations to rebound?
I'm not sure what I would call I'm trying to read through that. I mean, we have a very robust worm industry in the state of Maine. It's worth $4 or $5 million harvesting marine worms. We have seen a little bit of a decline associated with the size of the marine worms that are being harvested. A lot of times people will say the marine worm harvesters are impacting our shellfish beds. There's been a lot of work. Brian Beal at the University of Maine's done some great work there. Will Ambrose at Bates has done some work there. And we see very negative, little negative overlap in impacting one for the other, but it becomes a competition for the mud. Who gets to use the mud? And that becomes it becomes a lively debate sometimes.
So if someone's listening right now and scratching their heads and thinking worm harvest, worms are harvested for bait?
Harvested for bait up and they're shipped all over the country and in different places in the world. They're either a sandworm or a bloodworm. And we have two species here in the state, depending on they're either harvested in the mud or the sand.
And it's hard work.
Anything you're harvesting bent over with a rake in your hand is very hard work.
We'll go to Jim, who's calling from Presque Isle. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Why, thank you. I have a question. Years ago, I used to harvest Irish moss in eastern Casco Bay. Is there still an Irish moss fishery? It seemed to be impacted tremendously by invasive grasses the last time I was involved.
Yeah, Jim, thanks for that question. There is a minimal Irish moss. So on a very big draining tide, Irish moss would become exposed. And Irish moss is a seaweed that also acts as a natural coagulant. And I remember stories as a little kid talking about using – my mother's talking about using Irish moss to make pudding with because it would help coagulate the milk. So there is a minimal fishery left, but it's not to the extent that it was, say, back in the 90s.
Is there still processing in Rockman?
That, you know, Jim, that I can't answer with a confident yes. I think any product that had been harvested lately may have been shipped out of the state.
I gotcha. Thank
Jim,
you.
Thanks for calling. And we do have to go to another break. We're talking with Department of Marine Resources Commissioner Pat Kelleher. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs. And CMMC Urgent Care, quick care for minor illnesses and injuries, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. daily, 593 Center Street, Auburn.
Mansour al-Dafi wants a family and a future in a Muslim country. The U.S. sent the former Guantanamo Bay inmate to Serbia instead.
And when they brought him to Serbia, they make my life worse. They totally killed my dreams.
I'm Ari Shapiro, once a terrorism suspect, now out of Gitmo, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered with Nora Flaherty from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. And coming up in about 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, the Commonwealth Club of California welcomes Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards, discussing its history, its role in our political and cultural dialogue, and what the future holds for the organization. Again, that's coming up at 2 o'clock on the Commonwealth Club of California, here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the latest on a vital part of Maine's economy, its marine resources. I'm joined by the Commissioner of Maine's Department of Marine Resources, Pat Kelleher. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Pat, something we haven't talked about yet is the elver season. I've done some reporting on elvers. They're remarkable, also called glass eels, baby eels. It's really kind of been like the Wild West, the fishery, because the value has gone up so much in the last few years. What are you all looking at now? What could be changes in the elver fishery?
We've been in a status quo position with the elver harvest for the last 3 years. We're harvesting around a little under 10,000 pounds a year. That's with the value of ranging anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000 a pound. But we got pretty inventive in order to protect this fishery. And we went to a technology, a swipe card technology, the same technology that a credit card company would use to be able to track and have real-time harvest data during the year. And it's something that we're hoping that we're going to utilize in other fisheries. But for the elver fishery, when that elver is harvested, taken to a dealer, it is swiped at that dealer, and we have that data the very next morning. Then when there'll be a transition from dealer to an export dealer all the way to an airport, whether it's in Newark or New York or Boston, where they're going to be shipped overseas. And we track those elvers from the river all the way to that export point, where U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is talking to us on a daily basis to ensure that they're actually shipping out eels that were harvested in Maine. Heavily regulated, Maine is really the only state in the country. There's a very, very small fishery in South Carolina. As you said, the value was crazy. Because of the swipe card, we've eliminated the black market for the most part. When you have something that valuable, you're always going to have a little bit of a black market. We think it's being done incredibly sustainably now. The harvest was 20 or 30,000 pounds when you figured in what might have been sold in the black market. So with the with those management constraints that we put in place and utilizing this technology, we have a very viable, sustainable fishery that brings great economic activity to the coast of Maine and to areas of the coast that are some of our most depressed.
Now, I know that the Elver fishery right now is closed, but there are many people who would like to get into it, and understandably so. Is there going to be any opportunity for new Elver fishers? What would you call them?
I think they all just refers to themselves as Elver harvesters. But
okay.
There is. There's actually two bills. The department has a bill to make some slight adjustments to our existing laws and rules. But one of the components in our bill, as well as Representative Abden Simmons' bill, is a Elver lottery. So we'll take any non-tribal harvester who's gotten out of the industry, be it death or for whatever health reasons or whatever reason they've given up their license, we are going to put those back into the fishery. It makes really important to point out that it will not be available for this season. The bill has to pass, so it'll be in place for our 2018 fishery. If it passes, but we do expect it'll pass.
Okay. We'll go to, Joe calling from Edgecombe. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions, one concerning scallops again. Why is it that we only eat the hinges and we don't eat the body? I ask because I understand they eat the bodies in Europe, similar to clams and mussels and oysters and all that. That's question one. Question two is, what's with mackerel? I came back after 50 years away and hoping to be able to pig out on mackerel occasionally, and I cannot find it in any of the stores. And I've asked and asked, and I've never gotten any straight answers that I've understood. Is there something wrong with mackerel these days, or what's going on?
Well, we'll start with your scallop question, which is a great question. I was just asked this again the other day. The meat of a scallop is what controls the hinge. That's the muscle for opening and closing and for swimming. And that does not uptake toxin like other parts of its body does. So when you have a shellfish species such as a scallop that takes in toxins, you have to ensure from a public health perspective that that animal becomes clean. And we have done some special licenses to allow an aquaculturist to sell whole scallops with all of the rest of the parts. And we have done testing with them, and we're working with the aquaculture industry to continue to do testing to sell that whole product. But because scallops take in toxin, say, much differently than a mussel or a clam, which will, if you have a red tide outbreak and that red tide is taken into the body, it is then also filtered out of the body much quicker. A scallop will retain it for months, 2 months, 3 months at a time. So from a wild harvest perspective, it's very difficult to ensure from a public health perspective that we are doing the testing in a way that would protect public health.
And what about the mackerel?
Oh, that's a $64 million question. I mean, they're still available to catch along the coast with a diamond jig and to get a few in the spring and summer. I haven't really thought about buying mackerel in a store. I've never bought mackerel in a store, but the numbers have been down a little bit. The quotas, I believe, have been down. I'd have to go back and look. The herring boats do have a mackerel quota, which they're catching a lot. I do know that some of these larger midwater boats that do catch mackerel, a lot of those mackerel go into the pet food industry. So it's who's willing to pay the most. So that could be a component of why you're not seeing mackerel at your seafood deal. But I would, some of the better seafood shops, you should ask. Say, how come I can't get my mackerel now? And they may be able to source it somewhere.
Joanne, thanks so much for calling. I'm going to go to a Facebook question from Veronica. Please ask the commissioner to comment on the increasing threat of ocean acidification on Maine shellfish species for example, mussels and clams. I know a huge problem on the West Coast.
Yeah. Ocean acidification is something that, frankly, we're still all trying to get our arms around. It's been prioritized within NOAA Fisheries. They're starting to put some money towards it. We are looking at different ways to potentially mitigate ocean acidification. I think all in all, we have more issues associated with predation associated with shellfish, clams in particular, than acidification. But we do have hot spots along the coast where some people are seeing some changes in the shell thickness. So trying to understand what those are and how do you mitigate for that becomes a big topic, and it's something that the state and others are looking into.
All right. We'll go to Yarmouth and Peter. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hello. I was hopeful the commissioner could speak a little more in particular about the cod fishery and what the science reveals lately and who's conducting the science and the restrictions on the cod fishermen that exist right now.
So the restrictions, there's been nearly a 70% reduction in or more now probably with the last two management measures to reduce the overall harvest of cod. The work associated with monitoring cod, Maine does a spring, the state of Maine, DMR, does a spring inshore and inshore fall and spring trawl survey. That data, along with other trawl survey work that is done by NOAA Fisheries, feeds into the assessment work. Herein lies the conflict between science and fishermen, believing the science. Do you believe it? Do you not believe it? But at the end of the day, managers have to use the best available science to make the decisions. There's more and more, we're seeing more and more evidence associated with warming waters and that trend associated with where codfish are and where they're not, and it becomes a question if they're not here, are they just somewhere else? And harvesters or fishermen will say that they are. So it remains one of the biggest challenges that we face at the New England Fisheries Management Council as far as are we continuing to do the right thing for Gulf of Maine cod, and can Gulf of Maine cod recover? That was a big question in Canada with the collapse of codfish in Canada. And some areas they are seeing rebounds, but in other areas they see a very depressed stock still.
So it's an unanswered question.
Yeah.
Peter, thanks for your call. We have a Facebook question from Jamie. As a recreational scuba diver, I was just wondering why Maine has not successfully enacted a recreational permit system for in-state divers to harvest lobster, small scale. Is there a simple biological reason for this, or is the lobster lobby just too strong?
That is a law that was put on the books years and years ago, that the state of Maine made a determination that the lobster fishery would be a trap-only fishery and not be allowed to harvest any of this, that you can't retain them on a dragger and land them in Maine. You can't recreationally harvest them by diving. There was a lot of belief from fishermen will say that, you know, they're just taking them out of our traps. I mean, I've heard that countless times when this issue has come up before. But at the end of the day, there is interest, but the industry and the department have not been willing to make a change to open that fishery up for divers.
Mm. And this comes up from time to time.
It has not come up as a bill to be addressed through the legislature in quite some time, but I probably am asked about it at least once or twice a year.
If someone is a diver and brings up some lobster for their own family for dinner, is that illegal?
It sure is. Yeah, you can buy a recreational trap license and fish five of your own traps recreationally to harvest. But if you are caught retaining a lobster while diving, you are illegally harvesting lobsters, and my Marine Patrol officers will be happy to give somebody a ticket for that practice.
What about harvesting for yourself other marine species? What about mussels or...
Yeah, there are in different areas of the coast, mussels, clams, depending on if it's through the municipal program, you can gain access to flats for harvesting clams. For mussels, you need to be very aware of any biotoxin season during the summer with red tide. There's another biotoxin now that's in colder water that we saw for the first time last year. So we caution people if you are going to harvest recreationally to make sure that you are harvesting from an open area. And if you are not aware if it's open or closed, please contact Marine Patrol to ensure that you're in a safe spot to harvest.
Okay, so Marine Patrol, the best person, best place to go, your own town hall?
Not town halls, no. Okay. I encourage to call the department. The information's on our website, but sometimes a phone call is the easiest way to resolve it.
Okay, we'll go to North Yarmouth and Marie. Hi, Marie. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I have heard that the elvers that are harvested in Maine and sold out of the country are frequently then raised to full eel size or to adult size. If this is true, is there any way we could be encouraging that to occur more here in Maine? I've heard of one business doing it. I think that might tone down the Wild West business a little bit, just because anything you can go in and grab and make a lot of money does induce that kind of behavior or encourages it. Anyway, okay. Those are my thoughts.
And Marie's right. It's not many, but all of these baby elvers, these tiny eels, are taken to Asia, right, and raised in basically big aquaculture farms to full size.
They're all brought to several different countries within the Asian ring and grown out. They're put in ponds, grow-out ponds, fed, grown out to an anagi size, which is
sushi,
but 12 to 13 inches, or processed and smoked. Very, very popular. And the success of the value of our fishery depends on if those ponds have been filled or not filled. When they're not filled, the price is very high, which has been the last few years. So we think we've got the Wild West under control, but the question that you've raised is about processing and moving that to Maine. And there are at least two companies that are incredibly interested in this. There is one scientist who is doing it on a very small scale. We've granted a special license buys from a harvester and has grown them out to an adult size. She's created a niche market. I think she's going to go to the next stage. But the bigger, even the bigger question is, how can the life cycle be broken and then broken, probably the wrong term, but how can we figure out that life cycle so we can spawn them in captivity and not have that wild harvest going on? And that is a question that billions of dollars have been spent around the world in trying to figure out how to be able to spawn them in captivity to then grow them out. And it is one of the great mysteries when it comes to aquaculture to be able to do that.
It's too bad we're almost out of time, because eels are really interesting. The trek
interesting.
To the Sargasso Sea is not going to be just broken anytime soon. Marie, thank you for your really interesting question. And that's going to be it for Department of Marine Resources Commissioner Pat Kelleher. Pat was appointed commissioner in 2012. Thanks for joining us tonight.
No, thank you. It was great.
Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me and Senator Susan Collins for a conversation about the current events in our nation's capital. We'll discuss her votes on Trump's cabinet nominees, the latest on the investigation into Russian hacking, and her legislative priorities. And a note, we plan to stream tomorrow's program on the Maine Public website and the Maine Calling Facebook page. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.